Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Welcome to our Valentine's Day special. Sometimes there's nothing better than a seriously satisfying binge. So sit back and get ready for three hand-picked modern love essays. The first story you'll hear today was written by Gary Presley. Gary had all but given up on the idea of finding love. But as the romantics out there know, love can find you when you least expect it. And sometimes, even when you're resisting it. Colin Farrell reads Gary's essay. The actor is known for his wide-ranging work in the films In Bruges, The Lobster, and most recently in the Harry Potter spin-off Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Here's Colin Farrell reading Gary Presley's essay, Would My Heart Outrun Its Pursuer?
I am near quadriplegic, a result of polio, and I cannot stand. To be able to live in my own apartment as I desired, rather than in the custodial care of a nursing home, required the assistance of a rotating crew of attendants to transfer me from wheelchair to bed, bed to wheelchair, wheelchair to shower chair. You get the idea. The female attendants preferred to come in pairs, all the better to help a man into his bed and there undress him. I am somewhat deferential in the company of women, and I had made a conscientious effort to avoid any touch, any word that might be construed as improper. With that, the arrangement sailed along with no problems, soon settling into a job done and forgotten. At least until Belinda. A young mother of two boys showed up as half my attendant team. She was working evenings to pay for her college education. Earlier that day, I had noticed that part of the assembly of my shower chair was loose. Do you know how to use a socket wrench? I asked Belinda. Sure, she replied. I was a tomboy. I helped my father all the time when I was a girl. She may have grown up a tomboy, but what I saw was a beautiful woman. As the days went by, Belinda sometimes began taking her turn on my transfer schedule without a co-lifter. Doesn't it bother you to come alone? I asked. Why? I can outrun you. And with that, the necessity of my transfer faded into the background, and we began to talk about other things. Books and films, my work and hers. It seemed a natural evolution that after a few weeks, Belinda's routine occasionally included a friendly visit before she started her 3 to 11pm shift. One day, she dropped by with her sons. This is Matthew and Christopher, she said. The boys spoke up, even though Matthew, the younger, held tight to his mother's skirt. It was evident she had told them about my wheelchair. And so it was, that the man in a wheelchair, sardonic and standoffish, and the vibrant young woman who loved science and worried over how she would support her sons, developed an odd connection. A link to a place where hands might touch, but thoughts and feelings and emotions began to flicker like lightning beyond the horizon. I was past 40. My anger and frustration over being paralyzed mostly burned away. But it never occurred to me that the friendship, the connection between Belinda and me, might also be the bridge between caution and passion, between isolation and connection. I really don't see the chair, Belinda said a few months after we met. I see you. But I didn't believe her then. I had been paralyzed too young, when I was too callow and in a time and place where most people with disabilities were seen as invalids and shut-ins, passively accepting limitations and retreating behind an accepting smile to avoid injury, neglect, abuse or rejection. Belinda was 26, beginning study for a master's degree in microbiology, but she was also a single mother with minimal income. Nearly a decade had passed as she worked as a nurse's aide to pay for her classes and for daycare for her sons, and her life was becoming more hectic as she undertook graduate studies. I tried to help her with her boys, getting them ready for the bus when she had an early appointment, watching them after school and seeing that homework was done and bellies filled. One late summer day, Belinda asked me to accompany her to the nearby university city. "I need a man's opinion on what a professional woman should wear," she said. The master's program allowed her to supplement her income by working as a graduate teaching assistant. She was apprehensive about looking the part, and so we set out in my van. On the way, as we passed a restored Volkswagen Beetle in the adjacent lane, she pointed to it and said, "One of these days, I'm going to find one of those and rebuild it." Only half listening, I murmured, "If wishes were horses, beggars would ride." "What a mean thing to say," she snapped, turning away. She was driving my van. I sat behind her with my wheelchair secured by tie-downs. "I'm sorry," I said automatically, but I didn't understand what caused her reaction. The sardonic aphorism made perfect sense to me. I was an expert on wishes. "People have a right to dream," she said. We were quiet as Belinda bought dresses. She liked floral prints. I bought lunch and we drove to my apartment. As we waited for her boys' school bus to arrive, she sat on my couch. "I really didn't mean to hurt your feelings," I said. "It's all right. I shouldn't be so sensitive." I could see her despair reflected in the slump of her shoulders. I knew about despair. I wore it like a familiar coat, incapable of accepting what must be tolerated and petulantly ignoring what must be acknowledged. But at that moment, at the sight of such sadness in one usually so open and upbeat, sadness in the spirit of a woman who needed something from me, I wanted to offer more than mumbled words of apology. But I also knew that to push myself deeper into her world might carry us to a place where I might lose what I had made of myself. A place where I knew I could no longer hold tight to the hard reality that kept me sane. I believed I did not deserve to love Belinda. I believed I should not allow her to love me. I held hard to the idea I should be content to ride out the remainder of my life without complaint. A burned out case, an absurd hodgepodge of broken parts, a beggar who no longer wished for a horse. But she was also a woman, beautiful and vibrant, and I was a man, in a wheelchair, true, but a man full of heat and desire that sometimes rendered the chair irrelevant. And I was the keeper of an obscene little secret I had known perhaps since I had been stuck in the iron lung, and surely from some vague moment later, the point where I realized I would never walk again. It is a thing that will sit rancid in my gut until the day I die, a thing that until then had eaten away at any illusion that love and marriage for me would be like it was in books or movies. And it was this. I would be physically dependent upon those who might love me. I am a chore, an obligation, and I will ever be so. I could not rationalize how a woman might love me and not soon come to hate the millstone I believed myself to be. All this ricocheted through my mind, not in words, but in a fog of melancholic unease as I stared at Belinda. Suddenly she moved from the couch and across the few steps between us. I opened my arms, and she dropped into my lap and put her head on my shoulder. There was no sound, no words between us, only her tears and my silent wonder. Friends, lovers, perhaps that day was a hint that there might be a path through the thicket of my insecurities. I only remember the gift, the magic, the seamless transition from what I could never imagine into that which I will treasure until my last breath, a kiss, a touch, the sweet scent in the shadow of her neck. "We should stop this, you know," I said, my mouth against her hair. "You need to find someone else." "Where can I find a man silly enough to stay home with my boys when they have chicken pox?" she replied, smiling and lifting up to kiss the top of my head. "I like it that you put me first." Months later, Belinda stopped by my apartment and held out a small box. Inside was a man's wedding ring, a wide band with oak leaves inlaid into its surface. "See if it fits," she said. We now approach 2 decades married, and I sometimes still wonder at what love has wrought. I sometimes think Belinda might see in me a thing to nurture, a place to sacrifice, an altar on which to offer love. But I also feel something else. That glow from 2 decades ago. That heat between a woman and her mate. Cynics say romantic love is a fiction. I have been thoroughly in love only once. And I think it a mystery, an enigma, a Gordian knot entwining 2 spirits. But even now, I cannot fully resolve myself to the reality of Belinda's love. I choose to love Belinda, choose against my head logic and with my heart dreams. And even now, I confront the tasks with which she helps me each day with a mixture of the guilt and gratitude, resentment and appreciation, anger and bemusement. And somewhere deep in my psyche, an old, ugly beggar sleeps, unaware that the man Belinda chose to love has gotten on his horse and ridden away.
Colin Farrell, reading Gary Presley's essay, "Would My Heart Outrun Its Pursuer?" In a minute, Gillian Jacobs asks the 36 questions that lead to love. Welcome back. Our next story comes from Mandy Lancatron, a creative writing instructor at the University of British Columbia. When Mandy ended a turbulent, decade-long relationship, she wanted to take an entirely different approach to finding love. She abandoned her romantic ideals and instead turned to science. Gillian Jacobs tells her story. Jacobs is known for roles in the Netflix series Love, HBO's Girls, and NBC's Community. Here she is with Mandy's essay, "To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This."
More than 20 years ago, the psychologist Arthur Aaron succeeded in making 2 strangers fall in love in his laboratory. Last summer, I applied his technique in my own life, which is how I found myself standing on a bridge at midnight, staring into a man's eyes for exactly 4 minutes. Let me explain. Earlier in the evening, that man had said, "I suspect, given a few commonalities, you could fall in love with anyone. If so, how do you choose someone?" He was a university acquaintance I occasionally ran into at the climbing gym and had thought, "What if?" I'd gotten a glimpse into his days on Instagram, but this was the first time we had hung out one-on-one. "Actually, psychologists have tried making people fall in love," I said, remembering Dr. Aaron's study. "It's fascinating. I've always wanted to try it." I first read about the study when I was in the midst of a breakup. Each time I thought of leaving, my heart overruled my brain. I felt stuck. So, like a good academic, I turned to science, hoping there was a way to love smarter. I explained the study to my university acquaintance. A heterosexual man and woman enter the lab through separate doors. They sit face to face and answer a series of increasingly personal questions. Then they stare silently into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. The most tantalizing detail? 6 months later, the two participants were married. They invited the entire lab to the ceremony. "Let's try it," he said. Let me acknowledge the ways our experiment already fails to line up with the study. First, we were in a bar, not a lab. Second, we weren't strangers. Not only that, but I see now that one neither suggests nor agrees to try an experiment designed to create romantic love if one isn't open to this happening. I Googled Dr. Aaron's questions. There are 36. We spent the next 2 hours passing my phone across the table, alternately posing each question. They began innocuously. "Would you like to be famous?" "In what way?" And, "When did you last sing to yourself?" "To someone else?" But they quickly became probing. In response to the prompt, "Name 3 things you and your partner appear to have in common," he looked at me and said, "I think we're both interested in each other." I grinned and gulped my beer as he listed 2 more commonalities I then promptly forgot. We exchanged stories about the last time we cried and confessed the one thing we'd like to ask a fortune teller. We explained our relationships with our mothers. The questions reminded me of the infamous boiling frog experiment, in which the frog doesn't feel the water getting hotter until it's too late. With us, because the level of vulnerability increased gradually, I didn't notice we had entered intimate territory until we were already there, a process that can typically take weeks or months. I liked learning about myself through my answers, but I liked learning things about him even more. The bar, which was empty when we arrived, had filled up by the time we paused for a bathroom break. I sat alone at our table, aware of my surroundings for the first time in an hour, and wondered if anyone had been listening to our conversation. If they had, I hadn't noticed. And I didn't notice as the crowd thinned and the night got late. We all have a narrative of ourselves that we offer up to strangers and acquaintances, but Dr. Aaron's questions make it impossible to rely on that narrative. Ours was the kind of accelerated intimacy I remembered from summer camp, staying up all night with a new friend, exchanging the details of our short lives. At 13, away from home for the first time, it felt natural to get to know someone quickly. But rarely does adult life present us with such circumstances. The moments I found myself most uncomfortable were not when I had to make confessions about myself, but had to venture opinions about my partner. For example, question 22. Alternate sharing something you consider a positive characteristic of your partner, a total of 5 times. And question 28. Tell your partner what you like about them. Be very honest this time, saying things you might not say to someone you've just met. Much of Dr. Aaron's research focuses on creating interpersonal closeness. In particular, several studies investigate the ways we incorporate others into our sense of self. It's easy to see how the questions encourage what they call self-expansion. Saying things like, "I like your voice, your taste in beer, the way all your friends seem to admire you," makes certain positive qualities belonging to one person explicitly valuable to the other. It's astounding, really, to hear what someone admires in you. I don't know why we don't go around thoughtfully complimenting one another all the time. We finished at midnight, taking far longer than the 90 minutes for the original study. Looking around the bar, I felt as if I'd just woken up. "That wasn't so bad," I said. "Definitely less uncomfortable than the staring into each other's eyes part would be." He hesitated and asked, "Do you think we should do that, too?" "Here?" I looked around the bar. It seemed too weird. Too public. "We could stand on the bridge," he said, turning toward the window. The night was warm and I was wide awake. We walked to the highest point, then turned to face each other. I fumbled with my phone as I set the timer. Okay, I said, inhaling sharply. Okay, he said, smiling. I've skied steep slopes and hung from a rock face by a short length of rope, but staring into someone's eyes for 4 silent minutes was one of the more thrilling and terrifying experiences of my life. I spent the first couple of minutes just trying to breathe properly. There was a lot of nervous smiling until, eventually, we settled in. I know the eyes are the windows to the soul or whatever, but the real crux of the moment was not just that I was really seeing someone, but that I was seeing someone really seeing me. Once I embraced the terror of this realization and gave it time to subside, I arrived somewhere unexpected. I felt brave and in a state of wonder. Part of that wonder was at my own vulnerability, and part was the kind of weird wonder you get from saying a word over and over until it loses its meaning and becomes what it actually is, an assemblage of sounds. So it was with the eye, which is not a window to anything, but rather a clump of very useful cells. The sentiment associated with the eye fell away, and I was struck by its astounding biological reality. The spherical nature of the eyeball, the visible musculature of the iris, and the smooth, wet glass of the cornea. It was strange and exquisite. When the timer buzzed, I was surprised and a little relieved. But I also felt a sense of loss. Already I was beginning to see our evening through the surreal and unreliable lens of retrospect. Most of us think about love as something that happens to us. We fall. We get crushed. But what I like about this study is how it assumes that love is an action. It assumes that what matters to my partner matters to me because we have at least 3 things in common, because we have close relationships with our mothers, and because he let me look at him. I wondered what would come of our interaction. If nothing else, I thought it would make a good story. But I see now that the story isn't about us. It's about what it means to bother to know someone, which is really a story about what it means to be known. It's true you can't choose who loves you, although I've spent years hoping otherwise, and you can't create romantic feelings based on convenience alone. Science tells us biology matters. Our pheromones and hormones do a lot of work behind the scenes. But despite all this, I've begun to think love is a more pliable thing than we make it out to be. Arthur Aaron's study taught me that it's possible, simple even, to generate trust and intimacy, the feelings love needs to thrive. You're probably wondering if he and I fell in love. Well, we did. Although it's hard to credit the study entirely, it gave us a way into a relationship that feels deliberate. We spent weeks in the intimate space we created that night, waiting to see what it could become. Love didn't happen to us. We're in love because we each made the choice to be.
Gillian Jacobs, reading Mandy Len Catron's essay, To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. Gillian told us afterwards why she chose this story.
I have an increasing interest in science, which has taken me by surprise. And so I thought that this essay gave an interesting insight into the biological and scientific reasons behind love, and is also kind of squishily romantic at the same time.
And now a postscript with the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones, and the author of this week's essay, Mandy Len Catron.
You know, I was very nervous in the week before the piece was published, and I actually stayed up super late one night Googling other people who had had articles published in Modern Love and what the reception had been. And I remember the next day saying to my partner, all I want is just like not to have to go on the Today Show. And then the piece came out, and suddenly, like, I think within an hour, my sister was texting me and saying, people who don't even know you are sharing this on Facebook. And then literally the next morning, the Today Show called. And I was like, oh no.
If someone were to ask what is the most fun I've ever had in publishing a modern love essay, it would have to be this one. Mandy Len Catron's essay sort of blew the doors off the column when it came out and went viral in a way that nothing in modern love had done to that extent, and that really few stories published anywhere ever do. It led to an episode of The Big Bang Theory where the characters in the sitcom were asking each other the questions. It led to several documentaries where people were summoned to warehouses and paired up and filmed exchanging the questions. I wish I had statistics on couples that have resulted from it, but I know of at least a few that where the people contacted me directly. And not long after the essay came out, Mandy herself and her relatively new boyfriend were out having pizza, and her boyfriend typed something onto his phone and slid it across to her, and it said, the people next to us are doing the 36 questions. And she looked up and looked over and listened, and sure enough, in their own pizza parlor, they'd inspired this couple to do the 36 questions. So it was just sort of a steamroller, and it went worldwide.
So I think one of the important things to keep in mind about the 36 questions is that actually they've been used in a lot of different research, and really interesting research that has nothing to do with romantic love at all. So when Arthur Aaron first published these, he just wanted to see if he could create a sense of closeness between two strangers over the course of 90 minutes. I didn't think about it as like a life-changing experience. And I didn't think, oh my God, we're going to fall in love now. You know, I just thought like, wow, that was fun. And it was meaningful. Like it felt like a really great way to get to know someone quickly. And I felt like we were really close and that we would continue to stay close. And I had no idea what form that intimacy would take, whether we would be really good friends or whether we would start a romantic relationship. It wasn't like we just fell in love over the course of the evening. We really actually just developed a really intimate friendship, and actually the relationship became more serious and more romantic about 3 months later. So we are still together, which I know people are like dying to know. I almost feel like the fact that we're still together kind of oversells the power of the 36 questions, because I think people want it to be this guarantee that you can fall in love and find this life partner and that you're going to be really happy together. And so far, that has been my experience. But to me, like, the real value of these questions is not as a tool to fall in love, but actually just a way to find intimacy with someone. Because I think ultimately, like, we all just want to be known.
You know, to fall in love, obviously, you need to make yourself vulnerable to the other person. And the brilliance of this approach is how it gives you sort of a game to play. And everybody wanted to try it, except me. I have to say, I have not done this with my wife yet to fall in love again or whatever, to get to know each other better. But I have heard about a lot of married couples, not married that long or married decades, who did these questions. And they said that these were never things they had discussed in 25 years of marriage.
Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, and Mandy Len Catron, author of To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. She's working on a collection of essays that explore the role of love stories in our culture. It's called How to Fall in Love with Anyone, and it comes out in June. Coming up in a minute, Veep's Tony Hale reads between the lines in a messy breakup. This is Modern Love, the podcast's Valentine's Day special. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, let's be honest. It just wouldn't be a Valentine's Day without a good breakup story. Some of us handle breakups more gracefully than others. Steve Friedman's story of a particularly messy one became the very first Modern Love column ever published in 2004. Emmy Award winner Tony Hale reads this one for us. You might know him as Gary Walsh on HBO's Veep or as Buster Bluth in Arrested Development. Here he is with Steve's essay, Just Friends? Let me read between the lines.
She dumped me. What's important are not the details, but the pronoun placement. She preceding me. But there's no villain here. My therapist suggests I repeat this mantra to myself. So I do. There is no villain here. There is no green-eyed, wasp-waisted, pillow-breasted, sneering queen-of-the-damn villain who dumped me so swiftly and with such imperious, frigid beauty that I experienced chest pains and shortness of breath, leading to something called a cardiolite stress test, which I just discovered my insurance company may not pay for, and which has left me not only miserable and lonely and occasionally sobbing in public bathrooms, but also about $6,000 in debt. But no one is to blame here. My therapist suggests I repeat this phrase too. No one is to blame here. Did she have her reasons? Could I have been a better boyfriend? Is it telling that I was 48 when we met and never married, that I had spent the better part of 3 decades shedding wedding happy sweethearts as a tailback dances away from fiendish linebackers? And that I had recently looked in the mirror and seen staring back male pattern baldness and the egregious folly of my broken field running brand of romance? Ha! No good can come from dwelling on such questions. So, let's assume she had her reasons. What's important is not what she did or why. What's important is how I handled it. Personal setbacks and romantic rejection, according to authorities ranging from the Dalai Lama to the editors of Cosmo Girl, offer us all opportunities to behave with grace and courage and self-respect. They also offer the opportunity to do what I did. First, a day after she dumped me, I sent an email message, an affectionate, graceful, non-desperate note of about 200 words that I worked on for 3 hours. I remember how wonderful and sweet things felt with you, I wrote. That was good, I thought. Bold, yet sensitive. From laughing and kissing on the tennis court to drifting in the ocean to holding each other and feeling so lucky and grateful. I just wanted to let you know that. It's not bad. Heartfelt, but not clinging. And then I wrote, and I wanted to own up to the toxic stuff I brought to the relationship and to tell you how much you mean to me and to acknowledge the enormous amount of effort and kindness and love you brought to me and to our relationship. I wanted her back so bad it gave me a stomach ache. But I remembered with distress the time she had accused me of whining. I struggled over the last line for 20 minutes. I decided on, write back if you want, but you don't need to feel obliged. She didn't feel obliged, which made me want to call her, which made me want to have sex with her, which made me want to wake up next to her to grow old with her or to see her age and grow fat and ugly very quickly. She's dead to me, I told my friends. I was mentally ill to have dated her, I told my friends. Obviously a borderline personality, I told my friends. Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had, I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back. A week later, I received an email message. She thanked me for mine, apologized for not getting back to me sooner, admitted she was sad about how things had ended. Then came the key line. I just hope we can have some sort of friendship going forward. Ho, 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 ho! I decided this was her way of widening the dialogue. I decided this was her way of signaling that she was open to romance. I decided to ignore the advice of every single one of my friends, not to mention my therapist. I telephoned her and suggested we try again. She laughed. I persisted. She might have used the phrase just friends, but I have not been able to locate those words in the detailed notes I kept of our conversation. Besides, are the details really that important, huh? Didn't the fact that we had loved each other unconditionally and fully and intensely for 4 weeks and 3 days and 9 hours and 26 and a half minutes mean more than mere words? We made a date to see a movie. On the afternoon of, she canceled, pleading fatigue and an impending sore throat. She said she would rather make it another night. Was that okay? But of course it was okay. I'm an adult, after all, not a child. I'm not a child. She couldn't possibly suspect that I would be bothered by a postponed date, could she? Or hurt, suspicious, or deeply wounded, or reminded with a throbbing emptiness in my gut and sticking pain behind my eyes that when we were making out on tennis courts and drifting in ocean currents and discussing plans to hike in New Zealand together and holding each other in bed, nothing like a sore throat, excuse me, an impending sore throat, would ever keep us apart. Feel better, I offered majestically. Call her right when you're on the mend and we'll celebrate your return to health, I suggested. Manfully, powerfully, with confidence, no neediness there, no rage, no desperate cardiolite test-inducing words. Almost a week later on my birthday, as I was finishing a magazine profile, I received another email note. Hope you're having a V special day. Is the story done? XOXO. Oh. I spent that afternoon and evening deconstructing the text. 2 lines, not good. 11 words on my birthday, not good. The V instead of very, not so good. But perhaps I was misreading. Perhaps I was bringing my own insecurities to bear on a sweet, loving signal from cyberspace. I cross-referenced her word usage with all her other email, which I had saved in a special file, and made a startling discovery. She had used the V abbreviation before. Obviously, it was a literary affectation or just a communicative tic. I had been entirely too eager to see it in proof of withered feelings. And it would be blind and horribly unfair, would it not, to ignore the XO, a clear, unambiguous indication that she was ready to drift with me in the ocean currents again? Huh? I called her to clear things up. I didn't want to misunderstand her, I said. Did she want to date or not? She suggested I not call again. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah? Well, then I suggested she not call again and that she lose my email address. And furthermore, if she ever saw me on the street, she had better... She hung up. Oh, I stewed. I composed bitter letters about how she was incapable of love, how she didn't recognize the gifts I had given her. I did not send the letters. Thank you, 10 years of therapy. I drifted through the photos of her in my computerized slideshow, accompanied by Rebecca Luker singing Till There Was You over and over and over again. I lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks. Then, a blinding epiphany. I shouldn't have snapped at her on the phone. Of course she had recoiled. Who wouldn't? With the insight came a great sense of calm. With the calm, a sense of hope. With the hope, a plan. If I made her understand how much I loved her, how I in no way blamed her, and how I had changed and was now neither needy nor angry, but just a man filled with love and affection and magnificent intentions, then She might take me back, and we could get back to the ocean currents and tennis courts. This time I stayed away from the phone. Spoken language was so easily misconstrued. "I'm sorry," I wrote. "I'm really, really sorry." Then I elaborated. "You have no idea how sorry I am." Other literary high points included, "I was such an idiot. You don't know how much I miss you. I wish you'd give us another chance on whatever terms you want." A week later, she wrote back. She appreciated the apology. She didn't trust me. She wished me well. Didn't trust me. No wonder she didn't want us to travel in New Zealand together. Surely if she knew about the chest pains and shortness of breath, her doubts about my sincerity would vanish. Surely if I told her about the way I listened to the Music Man while mooning over her digital photos, she would come back. So I did. I told her. One more email message. I told her all that. I also cited lines from Casablanca and Malcolm in the Middle. I mentioned my prayers. That was almost a month ago. In that time, I've reflected on and marveled at the chilly and dignified silence that has been maintained by the women I myself have dumped over the years. I have thought of the pathetic old professor in The Blue Angel who Marlene Dietrich compels to cluck like a chicken, of the poor bastard in Endless Love, of every mopey mope whom Frank Sinatra immortalized in his greatest loser anthems. I've considered the Dalai Lama and Cosmo Girl way of life and realized that I behaved with all the dignity of a furious and heartsick and grievously wronged Teletubby. But I'm getting better. And finally, getting it. I know this because 2 weeks ago, for the first time in a long time, when a woman smiled in my direction on the subway, possibilities occurred to me. I know this because for the first time in a long time, I'm not racing to check my email every day or gazing at photos of her. I haven't destroyed those photos or the letters and email, as friends have advised, but I don't need to. This time she's really dead to me. Really. I mean it.
Tony Hale, reading Steve Friedman's essay, Just Friends? Let me read between the lines. Now, for those of you who don't watch Veep, the HBO political satire, it follows Selina Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as she takes on the roles of vice president and later president of the United States. Tony Hale plays Gary Walsh, her loyal assistant. And Tony told us that this essay really reminded him of Gary.
I think he does this with Selena, his boss. He just creates a world in his mind of how she feels about him, how I think one day he dreams of being the first lady next to her. He desperately wants them to be married, and he's just created this entire, you know, universe in his head of them together, and the reality is she doesn't even know his last name.
I'm next to the Veep more than any other human being. You are distantly orbiting her. I'm her moon.
Tony Hale as Gary Walsh in HBO's Veep. And now a postscript from the author of this essay, Steve Friedman.
The woman I wrote about was what I would call a very high-spirited woman and what my friends called crazy. And I was really off balance much of the relationship, and it was kind of a volatile relationship. And we hadn't spoken in a while, ever since she had neglected to return my way too many calls in the aftermath of the breakup. And then I wrote the piece, and I didn't hear from her after that. I suspect she probably read it because we had a lot of mutual friends. And I actually did walk by her on the street one day, right next to Central Park. And our eyes met for a second or two, and no words were exchanged, and that was it. So writing the essay really helped me make sense and see my behavior in a different light. Before I started writing it, I thought I was just a terribly grieving, wronged, sad guy. As I started to write it, I saw the pretty monumental self-delusion I'd been under, and how she'd been saying things pretty clearly, like, don't call me again and stay away. And I'd been hearing, let's give this one more chance. And behaving like that and losing weight and doing all the crazy things, you know, listening to our song over and over and over again, looking at her pictures, really did help me empathize with and understand some of the women that I've broken up with over the years, which, you know, which has helped me be broken up with and break up with people in much more graceful ways. And it's led me to be in relationships in more graceful ways too, and led to a wonderful girlfriend. So the woman I'm dating now is, she's fantastic and smart and pretty and kind, and I respect her, and sexy and loving and all that stuff, and very steady. She says how she feels, she listens to how I feel, so I'm grateful for that.
Steve Friedman, author of Just Friends, Let Me Read Between the Lines. His work has been featured in magazines, newspapers, and anthologies, and he's also author of 4 books, including a memoir called Lost on Treasure Island. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Valentine's Day.